Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The intensity and breadth of the wildfires in Australia has drawn attention to the effects of climate change and the need for greater commitment to countering the globe's environmental crises. What are the scientific and political links between the fires and climate change? Contributing host Doug Becker explores these questions and more.
Our panel today is Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Center for Climate Communication at the University of California, Merced, and Wenju Chai, principal research scientist at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization and a contributor to the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. Professor Westerling, we'll start with you. There's been a lot of conversation about the connection between climate change and these devastating fires in Australia. What exactly is the connection between the two?
So around the world, we've been seeing increases in fire in a variety of different ecosystems. And the two main drivers have been increase in temperatures. So warming temperatures result in more evaporation. And that increased evaporation dries out fuels. And at the same time, we've also been seeing the beginnings of evidence of increased variability in precipitation, where we're getting slower weather patterns that linger for longer, and we can get really dry, really wet conditions. And this can really ramp up fire risk as well. If you have extended dry conditions and warmer temperatures on top of them, you can get very extremely flammable fuels like we've seen in Australia this year. I believe this was the driest rainy season that they had in the modern record, and record temperatures on top of that. And so they've had very flammable fuel conditions and a very early start to the fire season.
And Professor Chai, we hear of these wildfires in different places. California's had wildfires, had fires in Brazil. What makes the Australian fires unique? And are they more devastating than other fires that we've seen in the past?
Yes, this time the fire, the area is really unprecedented. And I think our previous speaker, Professor, is correct that over the last 3 years, the area that now is burning has accumulated rainfall its historical low. And then you also have the huge high temperature, and that really is a perfect condition for huge fire. The unique feature of this one is the large scale of it and the fire season that starts so early. So normally the fire season would start around December, which is our dry season in southeastern Australia. But this one start much earlier, like, you know, late October already fire started. So far has burned so many months now, and that's really very unprecedented.
Now, Professor Westerling, I know that here in the United States, there seems to be a debate about what exactly was the cause of these wildfires. And some of the critics of the argument that it was caused by climate change have pointed out that there's going to be individuals charged with arson, and that the arson was the one that was responsible for the wildfires more than climate change. What exactly is the relationship between arson, climate change, and these fires?
So anywhere you look around the world, especially populated areas with Mediterranean climates, so places that have a long dry season and lots of people living nearby, you'll see that a very large fraction of the total ignitions typically come from human activity. So not necessarily arson, but accidental starts as well. For comparison, you know, looking at California, most of the increase in large fires around the western United States in forested areas has been in lightning ignited fires, because those are the biggest risk fires in elevations where we have forest area in most of the West. But if you look at where the fires have been happening in the last few years in the fall fire season in California that we've all been hearing so much about, so the Camp Fire that took out Paradise, or the Tubbs Fire, or the Thomas Fire that was burning in December a couple of years ago in Southern California, these all were happening in areas where basically all of the fires are always human ignited. But the thing to keep in mind is that very few fires, whether they're ignited by lightning or ignited by human activity, go on to become really large. So in California, and I think it's also true in Australia, although I'm not familiar there, it's basically about 5 to 8% of the fire ignitions that cause most of the damages. So for every fire that becomes large, there's dozens of other ignitions that don't go anywhere. And it really doesn't matter what starts the fire. If the conditions were conducive to putting them out, they would be put out very quickly, especially near populated centers. The only reason that these fires are getting so large and spreading out of control is not because of how they were started. It's because the conditions are so extreme. The fuels are so dry that you can't get them under control quickly enough. And once they grow past a certain size, you're always behind the curve, right? You're bringing in more and more resources to try and contain the fire, and it's spreading faster than you can encircle it.
With this in mind, certainly the fires have, pun not intended, reignited more of the debate about the need for some mitigation of climate change. But since the fires are taking place now, no matter what we do on climate change, these conditions exist, and there's the likelihood of other types of fires. So are there things that we can do that are adaptive, adaptations that we can implement to try to avoid some of the devastations of these fires, Professor Chai?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it is a huge debate in Australia. You see people now go to street to request the government take actions. Right now, the fire is burning. And this is not just this year. I mean, in 2009 in Melbourne, we had what we call Black Saturday. In that event, only a few hours from 9 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we have 173 people killed and more than 2,000 houses burned. So the evidence is there that these kind of more extreme blazes are occurring more often. And in southeastern Australia, you could see a climate change signals very clearly, not just in terms of the drying condition, which rainfall has been decreasing for more than 30 years, and temperature has been rising faster than the global average for more than 30 years. And the other thing is that in Australia, we are pretty much, our weather are very much controlled by what happened in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific El Nino normally give us the dry condition in northeastern Australia, including Sydney. And then the Indian Ocean, you probably heard of the Indian Ocean dipoles. Basically, it is a pattern of oceanic temperature, cool in the east, warm in the west. That's what we call a positive Indian Ocean dipole. And in Melbourne, for example, the rain season is in June, July, August, September, October, November. And that is precisely the season when the Indian Ocean dipole would develop and mature. So when the east is abnormally cool in the eastern Indian Ocean, the moisture that we get for rainfall coming from the northeast, that is in the eastern Indian Ocean, and under climate change, eastern Indian Ocean is warming a bit less than the west. So the moisture keep moving away from us, particularly in one of those extreme positive Indian Ocean dipole events. And 2009, that dipole is historically high, the second only to one previous event in 1997. And so once you have that event developed, you have winter, June, July, August, September, October, the whole 6 months had no rain. And summer season in Australia, December, January, and February, it's a dry season anyway. So you have all this hill built up for 9 months. But previous year, 2016, we also had that dipole, and that create a very conducive conditions for extreme fires for the southeastern Australia. And in 2009, prior to that summer, we had three consecutive Indian Ocean dipole events. That's why it could be so big in 2009 that killed 173 people in a few hours. And there are modeling evidence which says that under climate change, those kind of extreme Indian Ocean dipole variability, Indian Ocean surface temperature variability, will become more extreme, and the Indian Ocean Dipole event will be more frequent. And so there are mountains of climate change evidence that is impacting on Australia, not just in the background, but also in the spark that lights the fire, the Indian Ocean Dipole, the El Nino. And so in the longer term or middle to longer term, the best way to really overcome a situation like this is to mitigation, cutting greenhouse gas emission. Australia actually had an emission trading scheme, but the current Liberal government basically repealed it. And so we are still in the Paris Agreement, and there are also modeling evidence which suggests if you can achieve the goal of Paris Agreement, then those kind of extreme partial Indian Ocean Dipole event would stabilize rather than continue to increase as now projected. If we could achieve the Paris Agreement target, it's going to make a huge difference. So the voice is very strong that we need to start cutting emission, and Australia should take a leadership because we have a lot on the line. Our risk profile is much bigger. So yeah, cutting emission.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the Australian wildfires and the relationship to climate change. So, Professor Westerling, sort of the same question, but a little bit of a twist. With this question of mitigation, obviously the United States has withdrawn from Paris or is in the process of withdrawing from Paris, and that's gathered most of the attention about the Paris Climate Accords. But none of the states that have made commitments at Paris have actually hit those commitments. Can there be some expectation that the news coverage and the attention that's been gathered as a result of the Australian fires and, you know, recent fires could perhaps compel states to take mitigation more seriously? And then sort of as a follow-up as well, is there anything we can do with respect to adaptation, or should really the focus be on mitigation, on actually trying to slow climate change as opposed to trying to adapt to the fact that the climate is already warmed?
So we're going to need to do both, right? Mm-hmm. We have to mitigate and we have to adapt. And the reason is that there's such a lag between when we emit pollutants like carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and when they've had their full effect on the climate system and all of the other things like our ecosystems that are linked to climate. But at the same time, because of that long lag, it's imperative that we start taking really dramatic action to limit our emissions now, because things will only continue to get worse. Climate change isn't a one-off thing. There's no new normal that we can look forward to. Just accelerating changes that will increasingly destabilize our ecosystems and ultimately our economy and all of the services, all of the ecosystem services that our civilization depends on. Now, I think a good parallel, a good metaphor, a good example for how climate policy could work is really to look at the global agreement, the Montreal Protocol for ozone-depleting substances. So, like climate change, that was caused by industrial emissions of a pollutant that altered the composition of the atmosphere. In this case, the primary effect that we were concerned about was not global warming, although the chlorofluorocarbons that were destroying the protective ozone layer in the atmosphere are also greenhouse gases. But we were primarily concerned with the destruction of the ozone layer and the impact of increased ultraviolet radiation on humans and on agricultural systems and on ecosystems. And the thing is, we had more uncertainty back in the 70s about how all of that was going to play out, about the extent of the impact of the emissions of chlorofluorocarbons than we do today with our understanding of climate change. But we still started taking action at a much earlier point. And the initial targets that countries agreed to were fairly moderate. But once they started actually seriously attempting to meet them, there was a lot that we learned in the process that made it easier for us to further reduce our emissions of chlorofluorocarbons without damaging our economy. We learned how to make alternatives that weren't as damaging. We learned how to find substitutes that didn't cause a problem at all. And as a result, we kept picking up the pace of the commitments. And the cost that we incurred to actually meet them turned out to be lower and lower and lower than what had originally been projected. And at the same time, the science was coming in with greater and greater authority and certainty, saying this is a real problem and we need to take action. So if you look at the targets for ozone-depleting substances, they were constantly being ratcheted upwards, and the cost of meeting them was constantly falling. And it was a very positive sort of experience. And we have a lot of reason to think that it would play out the same way with climate change once we actually start, because we have a lot more technological options available now. Our understanding of climate science is much further along than understanding of the science that was relevant for depleting the ozone layer. But that whole virtuous cycle of learning, sharing information, and ratcheting up the ambition of our targets or anything has been short-circuited, basically, by misinformation campaigns and propaganda funded by large fossil fuel corporations in particular, but others as well, trying to cast doubt and confusion amongst the public on the state of the science and the costs that we would incur to take effective action now. And I think that era of obstruction is quickly drawing to a close. And I think we will see very dramatic action in the coming years on climate change. The problem is that because it's so late in the game, we're going to have a huge climate change impact that we have to learn how to adapt to. And ultimately, we're going to need to deploy technologies not just to reduce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions down to zero, but actually to achieve negative emissions. Right? So over the long term, we're going to have to do things that withdraw carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and the oceans and sequester them in a safer places to stabilize our climate system at a desirable level sometime in the 21st century.
And actually, you're parallel to the Montreal Protocols. From a political perspective, my own background seems rather striking, because not long after the signing of those protocols was the evidence of the hole in the ozone, which provided even more of an impetus for states to take those protocols, you know, much more seriously. And I wonder if these wildfires are the hole in the ozone moment that we have for climate change, considering the amount of coverage that they've had. So
the point to make about fire is that the number of people who are actually directly impacted by the flames threatening their property or their livelihoods is relatively small, but a much larger number of people is directly impacted by the smoke, by the air pollution produced by those fires. And so there's millions of people around the world now in these different places like California or the Western United States, Canada, Siberia, Australia, Southern Europe, that have had a personal experience with these really unusual events because of the smoke.
Yeah, precisely. Yes, I think that the smoke is causing huge rise in the PM2.5 readings. PM2.5 in Australia normally is very small, but in recent days, there are places that goes up to nearly 1,000 in reading, and that's incredibly high and very harmful. So many people are actually fleeing Australia so that they don't have to breathe those hazardous air.
And Professor Chai, you had referenced some of the anger that we're seeing in Australia. I know that the government has faced quite a bit of a backlash, in part because of its commitment to, for instance, to the coal industry, and some of the reversals of previous policies prior to the wildfires that seem to discount the potential threats about climate change. So, how intense actually are these, are these protests, and can we expect to see Australia and other regional countries just take this much more seriously because they're experiencing these effects of, the effects of the fires, the smoke, and everything else.
Right. So public moods change with occurrences of this event. So during the period of what we call millennium drought from around 2001 to 2011, we had a huge drought that lasts around 10 years. And almost every city was building a desalination plant for fresh water supply. And during that period, the public sort of support for climate science and for taking actions was really strong. And then we had a few years of reprieve from around 2011 to 2015. So we have reasonable rainfall, the drought wasn't a problem anymore. And then the public support for taking action has decreased quite a bit. And when this happened, it's because taking action actually involves a cost, and that actually affect people's bottom line, people's cost of living. And so now we can see a huge increase in the voice of taking actions. So I think this voice, this desire of taking action, willingness of taking action, comes and goes ups and downs. So I'm hoping this time that it will sustain and it will compel to people's voice. I mean, in a democratic country, you make the government, you choose a government that follow the majority of people's wishes and that change that government setting. So I'm hoping this time will do. And so it's not the right way to actually take actions, but it is the way in democratic country that we have to have the people's support in order for any policy to be implemented. And even if we were to stop emission and even carbon dioxide to stabilize at the current level, there is still a lot of impact that could occur because we have committed. The system hasn't digested the impact that we have emitted in terms of greenhouse gases. I mean, the last time the Earth system sees such a high carbon dioxide was around two and a half million years ago. So in a short period of 150 years or so, we have increased the carbon dioxide, which in the real system, the natural system, would take tens and tens of thousands of years to do. So there are a lot yet to come, even if we are able to cut greenhouse gas to stabilize, and which is not quite possible to stabilize straight away. Mm-hmm. So I think that government around the world will have to take actions. Mm-hmm. And through this kind of extreme events, I hope that it would make the whole picture, the long-term picture, clearer that that government really take actions. Mm-hmm. But that, again, comes from the people power.
A lot of times when we hear conversations about climate change, they're posed in, we need to do something because the future could be quite devastating. I think one of the lessons we should take about the wildfires in Australia and the devastation is the future is now. So hopefully this will be an important moment where we as a global population and certainly as national citizens start demanding much more comprehensive and aggressive action in trying to address climate change. Thank you very much. Leroy Westerling is co-director of the Center for Climate Communication at the University of California, Merced. And Wenju Chai is principal research scientist at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization and a contributor to the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, contributing host Doug Becker, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.